Evening, friends. I'm Tom Altenberg, and I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. My sobriety date is March the 29th, 2000, which means that today I'm 1,865 days clean and sober. Oops. Just sober, I guess. Say hey. Anyway. I'd like to thank... Where is he? Sandy. There he is. I'd like to thank Sandy for asking me to speak tonight. Normally, when somebody asks me to speak, my first impression is, and my first thing is always to say no. Right, Ray? I don't like to do things. Thank you. But this time, I was happy to, I was happy to notice for myself that some things have changed. I've gotten a little bit less selfish, a little bit less self-centered. So when Sandy asked me to share, I said immediately, yes, no problem, I'll share for you. Plus, I wanted to see what this meeting was like now that we're in the Tuesday beginner spot, and it's really, really nice. I say I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful at this moment. I don't usually act like I'm really grateful. I've got all those defects of character still that make me kind of hard to get along with, and but I'm grateful to be here right now. You know, I was saying, this is the type of guy, the book tells me I'm mentally and bodily different from my fellows. Not the fellows in this room, but the fellows out there that don't have the disease of alcoholism. So what that does is it makes me selfish, self-seeking, inconsiderate, and fear-based. So, I was on Friday night, before I went to Friday West End, I dropped in to see my children and my ex, the mother of my children, and she happened to say to me, gee, you're going to Friday West End, aren't you going to be late? And my response to that was, they should be lucky that I'm going to show up at all. And that is really what epitomizes my disease, is the attitude that everything revolves around me. The attitude that nothing can happen without my approval, and the attitude that most of the time, everything's out to get me. It's a disease that I suffer from, it's a disease of perception, I've come to realize. With your help, obviously. So, I won't go on too long. Let's see what time it is. So they asked me to say, our formula here, our book, asked me to share a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. Well, certainly today, as a result of 1,865 days of sobriety, I can say that as long as I've got the fundamental belief in a power greater than myself, do I trust that power? Not always. Do I refer to that power? Not always. But I know that as long as I don't drink, and as long as I don't take drugs today, it can't get any worse than it is on any particular given day, in any particular given situation. The eldest of four children, I grew up in a reasonably affluent section of St. Lambert, which is a town on the South Shore. If I didn't know what love was, it had more to do with what was going on inside me than anything else. My parents were good parents. My mother provided a good home for us. My father provided a good living for us. And there were three square meals on the table. There was clothing. There was education. There were vacations. There were friends. Is that screwing that up? Okay, I'll try to stand still. And that feeling of that I've heard so many of us share up here about being different had more to do with me than anything else. I didn't come from a background that was violent, that was abusive, that was, I hear so many of us get up here and share about horror stories. horror stories in their childhoods, and I can't say that. And ever since I was young enough to remember, I always had the sense of being different. And I've heard that described up here too. You know, I had a feeling of, the book describes it as restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. Right back to, I could remember till the age of 3. And as I grew up, that feeling got worse and worse and worse. I just never fit into anything. I'd be in a room full of strangers and be alone. I'd be the square peg trying to fit into the round hole, and roundabout, you know, that had this responsibility of being the eldest. I have 2 younger brothers and a younger sister, and it was a lot of poor me's, you know. So this feeling, as I get older, this feeling starts to become like a really nagging thing, this restlessness, irritability, and discontentment that I find described in the doctor's opinion in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I don't understand it. I'm a loner. I live in this fantasy world in my head. And I guess that's where I get my relief. Up until the age of 14, where at a high school dance, I have my first drink. Now, Little Pat on the South Shore happened to be my first sponsor back in 86 when I first came to this beautiful Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, describes that feeling of the first drink as heaven on earth. And if I ever knew any kind of comfort or any kind of solace or any kind of serenity or any kind of peace inside of me, it came from taking that first drink. And I would then, from the age of 14 to the age of 23, continue to chase that sensation, that emotion, that elusive everything that I felt from taking that first drink. 4 cans of Molson, by the way, in the middle of March on a street corner. My first drink was drank alcoholically. Nobody ever had a drink. I've never had a drink of alcohol before, and now I'm drinking 4 Molson in about 5.7 minutes. Whatever. The example is that from the first drink until the date of my last drink, every time I drank like that. And that day, folks, I was 10 feet tall. I went back to the dance. I was all of a sudden attractive. I was all of a sudden a good dancer. I was all of a sudden eloquent. I was all the things that I thought I was not as a result of taking 4 drinks. So what happens? Well, so, you know, the drinking is progressive. I suffer from a progressive illness. I'm mentally and bodily different from my fellows, which means that when I drink, I can't stop. When I start to drink, I can't stop, which makes me different from 99% of the people out there. When I start to drink, I suffer from a mental obsession that tells me that this time, I'm going to manage it okay. Regardless of past experience and past horror and past hangovers and past pain and past embarrassment, regardless of evidence pointing to the contrary, I suffer from the mental obsession that I can control and enjoy my drinking this time, which makes me different from 99% of the population out there. And thirdly, and most importantly, that the solution, the problem that I have with this illness isn't just that it's a medical illness. The problem is with my body. When I start drinking, the phenomena of craving develops that I can't overcome. No amount of willpower can overcome that. And the problem is also in my mind, so says the literature, with that mental obsession part. I am, as I said in the beginning, selfish and self-centered. And that is the crux of what ails me. I know and I have learned, I don't necessarily apply this, But I know and I have learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I put the welfare of others first, never mind first, even just equal to that of my own, I can attain and maintain what it says in the preface, the foreword to the second edition, permanent sobriety. If I put the welfare of others first, or at least equal to my own, I can attain and maintain permanent sobriety. Not always easy things to remember when I'm on a tear and I suffer from that disease of perception where, you know, in a heartbeat, you can be on my Christmas list and 5 minutes later you're on the top of the shit list. And that's what happens to me as an alcoholic. Anyways, I continued to go to high school. I continued, and I was always a floater. I was a coaster. I could get by with doing very little work and get a lot of credit for it. The other thing that I've heard many, 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 many alcoholics describe up here behind this table is that we have an ability to get by and look good. And it says in the big book, the alcoholic is very much the actor. To the world, he presents his stage character, but he knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. And when I read that big book, it's as though they're talking about me. So I got by, I coasted through high school, I got fairly decent grades, not honor roll grades, but little high 70s, you know, 80s, the 90 and something, you know, my average was just under 80, and I never opened a book. So when I got to CJEP with all the drinking, and it was progressive, I mean, it started out every 2 weeks, we'd go on Crescent Street, we'd go on the corner there, Casa Pedro and Gringo, and God knows what else, the other places, you know, and it went on and on and on, and 9 years later, in 1986, now we weren't drinking there anymore. We weren't drinking in the fancy places. We were drinking at the clay oven. Who remembers the clay oven?
I worked.
Right down there. Somebody worked there. See, right down there on between. That's right. The clay oven. The clay oven we drank. And we drank outside, and we drank in the car, and we drank here, and we drank there, and now we weren't drinking every other weekend in the fancy places. We were drinking Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I'm going to end that first part of the drinking by just qualifying a little bit, because I'm asked to qualify. I said, I'm different than 99% of the population, i.e. social drinkers, or people that just don't drink at all, because there's no need to. Social drinkers do not walk from metro station to metro station just because the train didn't show up. It just doesn't happen. A social drinker won't do that. I do. Social drinkers, when they can't find a bathroom, they wait until they find one to have a leak. I do. Social drinkers don't climb up on the superstructure of the Jacques Cartier Bridge and probably live to tell about it. I did. Social drinkers, when they're having a gathering on St. Helens Island and they put that little bonfire going there in that little barbecue pit that they have all over the place, they build a reasonable fire. They don't take a picnic table and put it on the fire. I did. Because it seemed like a good idea. Lots of stuff when I was drinking seemed like a good idea. Then the fire department came out. With the truck, the cops came, they took down all our licenses, the fire guy came with a hose and put out the picnic table. Now, even if a social drinker would have gone and done that, he wouldn't have gone out to the next pit 10 minutes later when the cops disappeared and did it again. It just doesn't happen. Drinking in those 10 years, in those 9 years and whatever, led me to situations that were disgusting, that were obscene, they were vile, they were dangerous, they were criminal, and I never once connected the dots on that. It was like me dealing with one of the guys that I sponsored about a year and a half ago. I'm not going to mention any names, and nobody knows who this fella is, but we picked him up out of a crack house, and we brought him into the car, And he said, you know, my thing isn't going well, and my career isn't going well, and this and that. Well, you've been smoking crack for 24 to 48 hours. You haven't gotten any sleep. You don't have any kind of long-term sobriety, etc. And the fella could just not connect the dots on that. That was causing him not to succeed in life. And that's how I was. It was never drinking. It was always somebody else's fault. It was always something else. And I didn't have the right upbringing. I didn't have the right education. They didn't get me a bicycle that was red when I was 6 years old. Anything but look at myself. So, what happens? What happens is that I meet a girl, and high school's over, and of course, you know, that thing about not opening a book, what happened was that I got booted out of CJEP, because in CJEP you're going to have to open a book. Because all of a sudden there's an accelerated learning curve, or there's something that you got to learn more. And of course, there's the freedom that every alcoholic deals so well with, that you don't really have to show up for class. They don't take attendance. You don't have to go there. So they had this beautiful place called the Band Ring at the Champlain College on the Longdale campus, where, you know, it was dark, a lot darker than here, and the college radio station was in a booth somewhere. They never actually saw the guy, but there was somebody in there playing records, and there was all kinds of pot smoking and hash smoking and drinking, and I thought I'd arrived. I come to see Jeff in my gray flannel slacks and a nice, you know, crimson red shirt, nice shoes and a briefcase and a bottle of Johnny Walker, 26 ounce in the briefcase, and every Friday we would go there and drink. Now, I got tossed out of there. I went back, I did the 2-year plan in 3.5 years, half-heartedly, and all along I'm drinking, I'm working to support my drinking. I meet a girl, we're drinking, and we decide to go to this guy's wedding. Coincidentally, this guy's now my sponsor, and he's now sober. But we go to his wedding, and he wasn't sober then, and neither was I. And we pick up this dog, the litter of puppies. Girl I was with, she fell in love with a little puppy, brought the puppy home. So the sane idea is to just abandon where you're living and move somewhere where the puppy will be welcome. So that's what we did. We rented an apartment for the puppy, and we moved in with the puppy. And it didn't work out. And we are all surprised. It didn't work out. It seemed like a good idea. And we drink and drink and drink, and at this point there were car wrecks, there were car accidents, there were accidents, there were arrests. The cops had picked me and this guy up, who's now my sponsor, you know. And we gotten arrested a couple of times for public mischief and vandalism and God knows what else. And we were supposed to be married, Monica and I, and that seemed like a good idea too. And one St. Patrick's Day in 1986, I was over here at a place called Chicago's, which is now McGibbon's Irish Pub, after the parade. And I got to tell you something, that parade ain't nothing now that I'm sober. You know, that ain't nothing. It's got to be a pretty hot March the 18th for me to stand on a street corner for 4 hours. But when I was drinking, wild horses couldn't tear me away from that. We'd stand knee-deep in slush, snow, come sleet, like the U.S. Postal Service we were there with the wineskins and the cases of beer and this and that. And that day, something wasn't going right for me. No matter how much I drank, I wasn't getting drunk. I was feeling shitty drunk, I was feeling shitty sober, and I was at McGibbon's Irish Pub, Chicago's, and they were all doing shooters. I went to the Instabank machine and I went home. The next day, she shows up, because that's the way it went with us. One of us would come home, the other one wouldn't. It didn't matter who it was, but there was always some sort of chaos going on. And, you know, we talked many times about joining AA. And, you know, everybody does that, I guess, when they're drinking. You know, you got a set of stones on you when you're drinking. But, the next day, AA. the pounding of the head. And then, you know, I was drinking in the mornings, and I had the thing, you know, with the beer. You know, that thing with the beer on the nightstand, and you walk stumbling to the kitchen, and you open the freezer, and you take out some ice and put it in a glass and put the beer in there, so at least the beer is cold so you can have a drink in the morning, because there's nothing left. And what about this one? You go to the party, you run out of beer, so there's a bunch of dead soldiers around, you take a swig, and you end up with a cigarette butt in your mouth. I mean, that's happened to so many of us also.
Yeah.
So she calls me up, I'm at work, and she says, I can't go on like this, Tom, we're supposed to get married, blah, 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 I've decided to join AA. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Because if I could pitch anything good, I could pitch my drinking. I could sell that. I could sell that in a heartbeat. Oh, we're not that bad. Ah, that happens to everybody. Really? Happens to everybody. They go to the wrong house, and they try for half an hour to open the door with a set of keys that they can't even see. You know? But I went. Seaway group, St. Lambert. John Coop was standing at the bottom of the stairs, and thank God that there were greeters at that meeting, because he literally reached out and pulled me down the last six steps. And I sat at my first meeting. I had holes in the back of my pants. I hadn't shaved for 3 days. I think I weighed 160 pounds soaking wet with a Gazette under my arm. And a little Pat came and tapped me on the shoulder. I held half a cup of coffee. And he said, it's okay, kid. It's going to be okay. And I didn't look back for 10 years and 11 months from 1986 to 1997. I didn't look back. Got involved. Went to meetings. The obsession to drink, the thirst, the hunger for alcohol was instantaneously lifted. I remember leaving that first meeting saying to Monica, you know what? I feel funny. I feel like a kid with a new toy. You know, Christmas when we were kids, and it was so exciting when you got that thing that you were waiting for the, you know, October, November, December, or maybe even earlier, September, October, and you unwrapped the present, and it was exactly what you wanted. And the thrill and the euphoria and the emotion from that lasted for so long. You couldn't wait to get up and play with the toy again and again. That's how I felt as a result of my first AA meeting. And every single one of those promises that we find on page 83 started to come true for me. That thing with that girl didn't work out. It was too bad. Got involved in the young people. A couple of people here, Karen, Sandy, still from the young people back then. And things were easy. Everything was handed to me on a silver platter. And I got this kind of through osmosis. I sat my ass in a chair and that's how it went. I did what was suggested. I did what I was asked. And bit by bit, things started to come together. And for the first 6 years of my sobriety, I really cherished it, and I realized I was grateful. You know, they talk about that pink cloud. That pink cloud means that I'm grateful to be sober. That pink cloud wears off when I start developing expectations. Well, I shouldn't have this. I should have that. And she should be more like that. And if they gave a shit, they would be like this. See, that pink cloud lasted for me for a long time, and I met some really good people, and I went to French meetings, and I got that young people's thing, that service thing. It was second to none. It was the best thing that ever happened for me. I lost all my introversion. I lost all my shyness. I got involved in sales. I started to make a living. I met a girl. We got married. We had two beautiful children, 92 and 94, Tommy and Daniel. And things were going well for us. And bit by bit, I stopped coming. And there's a story in the big book about this guy that takes a drink after he's retired. He suffered he was mistaken about the idea that he could, after a long period of time, drink like an ordinary guy. I even knew kind of that I couldn't. But there's a saying in AA that goes something like this. When you don't go to meetings, you don't get to see what happens to people that don't go to meetings. And that's what happened. The last cake I took was 6 years. I got into the habit of not drinking. But that's all I did. And I abandoned my higher power. I had other higher powers all of a sudden. I had limousines and sales parties and girls and money. And a nice place to live, and cars, And those became my higher powers, and I started to serve those higher powers instead of serving the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and putting the welfare of others first. I put my own welfare first, and it became all about me. And around about 1987, at the age of 34, I had some dental surgery, and I said to myself, I just wasn't feeling good anymore. Everything was boring. My wife and I weren't getting along. I couldn't understand. She was being so unreasonable. I was never home. I was never attentive. I was always busy with my businesses and my friends and that big ego-feeding thing that goes on in business, you know? And I can't serve the higher power and the ego at the same time. It just doesn't happen. And I had that dental surgery, and I said to the doctor, I said, why don't you prescribe me some painkillers? And he says, well, how's Tylenol? I said, no, something better than that. Not something better than Tylenol. So he says, how about some Percodan? And I said, set me up. And in true alcoholic style, you know, like those four beer, the bottle says take one every 3 hours, one little orange pill every 3 hours. I took three. And I went home and played around the backgammon with Gal. And I couldn't shut up. I was yapping. And then it seemed like a good idea to not be afraid of anything. So I spent the next 10 days driving around looking for cocaine. The reason that I wanted to do cocaine was because I could afford it, and I didn't need to be afraid of it, because I was the master of my own destiny. And I'm driving around like a schmuck every night. By then, you know, I have a place downtown, I have a girlfriend on the side, and I thought I was managing things well. And then it occurs to me, can you get anything you want in the city of Montreal if you won't pay for it? And it said, the light bulb went on. Another good idea. Go down to Saint Laurent and St. Catherine. And they hooked me up with a bunch of blow. And from 1997 to 2000, I did mountains of coke, big rocks of crack, and tankerfuls of booze. Tankerfuls. Snort, smoke, drink, take the edge off. And that stuff, that combination, like Bill says, landed me on the rocks. It wiped out five successful businesses, a place in Westmount, two cars, a family. It's funny, how I'm talking about all the material stuff first. Lost my wife, lost my children, lost my partnerships, lost my friends. And on the 28th of March of 2000, I was lying on my living room carpet, bleeding out of my nose, my mouth, and my ears. In a cocaine and alcohol-induced seizure. And in those 3 years, I did the thing. I ran into the noon meeting 20 minutes late, left 10 minutes early. I went through the motions. I went to NA because nobody knew me there. The pride's the last thing to go all the time. You know? Because I had traded my sobriety for my self-will. You know, and then I had all these cockamamie ideas about, well, I'll quit on this anniversary and I'll quit on that anniversary, and so my sobriety date is going to be Christmas Eve. How romantic can that be? You know, just always with the dreams and the fantasies, all the while not knowing that I wasn't asking for help. I was still trying to get the dosages right. I was actually measuring the gin in a measuring cup. Nothing helped. And on the 29th of February, because I thought it would be cool to have a sobriety date on a leap year day, I quit for 29 days, everything. And I decided to celebrate on that 30th day, or whatever it was, on the 28th of March, I decided to party, and that was the party that ended all parties. I came out of that seizure with the idea, somehow, for the first time in 10 years, or whatever it was, I felt the presence of God. And I knew that I wasn't going to drink or use drugs again. It was combined with a vision of my two youngsters standing over my grave and their mother having to explain to them what happened to Daddy. Daddy didn't get killed in the car crash. Daddy didn't get killed because he had some sort of a cancer or something that he couldn't do anything about. Daddy died because of his selfishness. I heard that loud and clear. And with all the blow I did that night, and with all the drinking I did that night, I went to their room and I got their two stuffed animals and I slept like a baby. And I woke up sad, sick, and miserable because I had to come back here. I had to come back to the people that I judged. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous was a bunch of losers as far as I was concerned at that point that had nothing better to do. And you know, today I understand that God sent me to the very best. Because I got up at the sister fellowship that night down at Loyola on a Thursday night, and I got up and I finally took, won't be long, Ray, I'm almost done. I finally took that beginner chip, and I never looked back. 1,865 days later, I've come in here, and I've worked this program. And you know that thing about the first time it's a gift, and the second time you work for it? Both times it was a gift. It's just that this time I made a conscious choice that I needed to do some things. And one of the first things that I realized is the only requirement to stay sober is a desire to stop drinking. So I said to myself, now some good ideas were starting to come. No matter how hard I tried, the car always did an autopilot. I'm not drinking tonight, I'm not doing good luck that. Right? And all of a sudden, you know, like I'm leaving my girlfriend's place, and I used to wait until I was in the car to dial the dealer's number. I'm dialing the number as she's closing the door to the apartment on my way down the stairs. I'm calling the dealer after I vow. I mean, that's insane. Step one is that when I start, I can't stop, and when I'm stopped, I can't stay stopped on my own. I don't know what to do. So I come back here. And you tell me what to do. Believe in a higher power, which I had a sense of. So I come back and I take that newcomer chip and I don't look back. So what do? I triple my desire. I go to three meetings a day instead of one. And by it comes. It comes, and there were things and challenges and situations I can't begin to tell you that I could never have figured out had I continued to use, and had I not died that night, somebody would have put a bullet in my head 45 days later. That's how serious the doo-doo I was in. I owed hundreds of thousands of dollars and not to the Royal Bank of Canada. It was not a stiffable situation. And you folks and a higher power work that out for me. What did I do? I showed up. I helped what I did could. I did what I could. And I was humble enough to be teachable. Why don't you look at it this way, Tom? Why don't you come up and speak? Why don't you come and start this group with us? And instead of saying no, I just kind of did it. And things started to evolve, and all the promises started to come true again, and I was able to put my family, see my family again, see my kids again, put the businesses back together again, make the businesses profitable again, have friends, have a host of friends. The most important thing that I learned from working this program is that I am the cause of my own downfall. The enemy is me. In doing my fourth and fifth step, I realized that I'm fear-based, I'm selfish, I'm inconsiderate, and I'm dishonest. And I can't wish those things away any more than I could wish away the booze and the alcohol. I have to place myself to be of maximum service and ask God to take those things away and at least be willing. I have to set right the wrongs of the past. And I went and did that. I made more than 50 or 60% of the amends that I needed to make as a result of the things that I screwed up. There's a guy that wrote a book called A New Pair of Glasses, the early members of AA, and he talks about rubbing out the record. Another fellow talks about picking up the tab. If I broke something, I need to pay to have it fixed, and not just pay money to have it fixed. Step 10 and 11 and 12 are my maintenance steps. And you know, one of the things that I love most about this program is that I can get myself out of my crap instantly if I'm willing to. And the best way that I know how is to help another alcoholic. Help anybody. But something seems to happen when I work with another alcoholic, when I do something for or with another alcoholic, because the book tells me that because of what I suffer from, I can be uniquely useful, meaning I can help as a result of what I know about my drinking when no one else can. And it is my duty and my obligation to do so. And every time I do that, I feel great. And I am grateful to this program, and I'm grateful to this program of recovery because it's given me back my life. 5 years and a few months ago, I could have been dead. It could have all been done. And since then, so many good things have come into my life as a result of following a few simple steps and being willing to maintain a simple attitude. And I'm not always willing, guys. And I'm not always nice. And I'm not always sober, like sober means I don't drink and I don't use drugs. But I'm not always clear thinking. However, I have found that doing that daily inventory and working with other alcoholics and coming to as many meetings as I can relieves me of this bondage of self that we talked about in the third step prayer, where it's just all about me and I wonder what about me and what's going to happen and what's going to go on next and blah, 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 blah. The committee starts going. And this kind of thing here cuts all that out. And you can hear clearly what's supposed to happen next. And it's okay. So, that's it. I feel grateful. We were at a big book study yesterday afternoon, and it's funny. When I read that big book, I read the foreword to the first, second, third edition. I read Bill's story. I read There Is a Solution. I get into those chapters. I read the doctor's opinion, and I just can't. The tears come. And I was sitting at the Annex Ed yesterday, and I was reading that, and I felt like an idiot. I was sitting there and there were tears rolling down my cheeks, and it happens every time I read the beginning of the big book. And I realize today it's because I'm grateful that Bill didn't stick in the bar at the Mayflower Hotel. He didn't go to the bar. He went to the directory, looked up a church, called Sister, found Bob, and started this beautiful fellowship on June the 10th, 1935. And had he not done that, none of us would be here today. And it goes to show you, this thing that we have spreads deep, and it's important, and it's vital work. So that's why I sit and cry like a baby when I read the big book. Not as good as I want to be, not as good as I can be, but I'm better than I was. Thanks for asking me to share, and I love you all. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Tom. It's all my privilege to thank you. Last clip. This clip? Oh, not here. Sandy.
Hi, my name's Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sandy.
And this is what I get for being chairman of the United States.